It's early winter in the months just before COVID hit, and I'm standing next to a baby lamb on a hill in one of the oldest commercial wine estates in the world. We are on a little green glade under a canopy of trees with a horse paddock, a nearby river, and a full view of the Sawtooth mountain range they called Montserrat, where the eternal soul of the Catalan people lives on in collapsing grottos under limestone cliffs. This week's guest, Pepe Raventós, is the 21st generation of his family to work on this estate, and this here is the perfect place, the perfect vista, from which to contemplate the calm and everlasting nature of things. I say that because this is the first of three episodes I recorded in and around Barcelona just before the pandemic. And in the chaotic and confined months that followed back in New York City, it was hugely calming to be able to think back to that hilltop in Penedès, to remember that the Raventós family has been working that same land since 1497, that they and their wine had survived centuries of pestilence and famine and war. It didn't hurt also that I got to do all that contemplating while drinking my very own bottle of Raventós y Blanc de Nit 2017 sparkling wine, which is, as it turns out, a very therapeutic bottle. This is Nathan Thornburg, and from Roads and Kingdoms, you're listening to The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world. You were a New Yorker. Let's start right there.
Yes, we went to New York in 2011 for kind of like pursuing a family dream to spend some time together in the U.S. and far away from the social responsibilities of living in a Latin culture. And so,
are you talking about like hanging out with your in-laws or something?
Exactly. We're like, this is very cool, but at the same time, it can be really exhausting because we're all together in the same barrio.
Fair enough.
So we moved to New York, and actually what was a one-year experience ended up being a five-year phenomenal family experience. So we spent 5 years in the boring Upper East Side.
Okay.
Actually, we were based in the area of Yorkville. I like to say Yorkville and not the Upper East Side.
Yorkville, yeah. The old German neighborhood by the river.
Exactly.
It's a nice spot. The apartments are a little bigger. You got the river nearby. There was a pretty entertaining profile that I think it was a Wall Street Journal did of you while you were in the middle of your Manhattan moment. And there were some nice little gems that you dropped in there, including, I think, when the interviewer had asked, why didn't you just move to London or France? And you said, this is not a vacation.
Exactly. We were it's been amazing how the American, call it a wine family, has adopted us. And, our story and the passion behind what we do and the fact of offering something different has captivated the wine community there. While sometimes in Europe, if you don't do or say what your grandparents or great-grandparents or great-grandparents said or did, it's like that, you make nonsense. Whereas in America, you feel like you are more open to other ideas, to other thoughts, to other flavor profiles, to any story. You know?
It is the least American thing I can think of, though, to be a 21st generation?
Yeah, 21 generations in the same farm, yeah.
21st generation farmer. As any student of history will know, I think we've got like, I don't know, 8 generations even possible for most of the colonizers anyway in the United States. So you found in New York a place where some of that weight is then lifted off of you, the extremely tall column of generations before you.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe so. But I think New York is this place still for us, where you learn to find the best of yourself. That's how I would put it. It's it's there are a lot of people, but you're so lonely that you know, you really need to find this balance, no? And like, how do I survive in this jungle? And maybe it's this, and maybe the fact that yeah, there's strong energy, you know, that everybody's like pursuing something at high intensity.
What was the best of yourself that you found? What changed in you in 5 years as a New York man?
I think the best was that what we were trying to do was possible.
That, what was that?
That was building some category for a wine that is still not existing. No? It's so our dream here is to propose an alternative to champagne in the world, which we love and respect and have many friends there, and I've been fortunate to do a lot of internships. However, it doesn't make any sense to me that when we have to celebrate with bubbles, always we go to champagne, while with red wine, for example, you can choose Burgundy, Piemonte, California, Oregon, La Rioja, or Australia, to say a few, no? So really, to break a little bit the box and living in New York, we decided to declassify from our existing DO that my family created in the 1800s, well, officially in the 1900s, but it all started mid 1800s. And really, like, declassify and start from scratch and you know, like, close a window and open a lot of doors.
So this is really crazy when I say that with love, but that is what you did. So Cava was essentially the kind of champagne method, sparkling wine that was produced in Catalonia. It was your forefather, you're going back to the early 1800s,
correct,
right? Who'd first brought this secret of monk Dom Perignon or whomever had created this champagne. But Cava is Cava. It's the most widely recognized, certainly, name of sparkling wine outside of champagne. And you somehow decided, no, fuck that. We're not going to call our stuff Cava, even though we're making sparkling wine in Catalonia anymore. That, to me, well, it's a bold move. Mm. Why?
Yeah, because Cava has evolved as a method wine, and method is a recipe, but it's not what make wine great. What makes a wine, in my opinion, great is just as simple as the origin, no? Where it comes from, and be able to interpret the small details of where it comes from. And for this, we really thought that we needed to start from scratch, because the inertia of Cava is too strong. There are too many millions of bottles, too cheap in the supermarkets, which is great for everyday celebration or a low budget celebration. And this is something I really respect. But in our case, we felt that we had the responsibility to take it to the next level, like you say in America. So
we do say that all the time.
You say that all the time. And another thing that you say, and I love and inspired me is, Pepe, don't hate the players, change the game. So basically this is what we do.
That is definite Spanish winemaker slang right there. Don't hate the player, change the game. That is what you, I mean, it's, did you not have somebody in marketing who was like, oh my God, you're going to kill me with this? Because now you're creating something, the new name, that's the new appellation, right, for what you do.
Exactly, Conca del Rio Anoia. Yeah, everybody wants to kill me, like all the distributors, importers, because it's like Conca del Rio Anoia. Could you make it easy? But it's like, dude, this is the name of the place. It's the valley of the river Anoia. I'm not going to change that. We have to go like really transparent here.
It is transparent. So it's Conca for short?
Yes.
That's manageable.
Yes.
And so Conca Cava.
Please call me Conca.
Mr. Changing the game, Conca. What were some of, and of course I love that you did make that decision in New York. It feels like a safe distance from Spain in which to survive. I'm sure there was outrage here or something, because you make a very high-end product, and essentially you were saying, as you just said, that like you didn't feel the association with the name Cava was worth the kind of product you were making. Were the other Cava producers like, what the fuck, man?
And still 8 years later, I am considered the black sheep of the region. But the time passes, and it still affirms the decision. No, really, there is a potential. There is an immense potential for what is happening here. But we really need to, I think, be very, very, very honest and set new rules. For example, I like to remind that a vine is like an olive tree. Nathan, it belongs to the Mediterranean. I mean, this is where everything started, as you know, in Georgia and in Armenia, and then the Phoenicians, and well, first the Egyptians and the Phoenicians, the Greeks, the Romans, spread it all over the Mediterranean. No? And then it was also spread all over the world, and this is fantastic. But we are in the birthplace of the viticulture, and not only from an historic perspective, but from a physic perspective, from a nature perspective. A vine likes poor soils, limited rainfall, dry-ish weather patterns to produce naturally regulated yields of fantastic balance and express origin. No? How many olive trees do you see in Champagne?
I'm guessing not many.
Yeah. So nothing against it, but we really need to gain a little bit more confidence in the Mediterranean shores about the potential of our climate and linked to the history, no?
Well, wine is struggle, right? The vine needs to fight for. That's how it kind of builds the character, and that is true. Mm-hmm. That some wine growing regions are just too damn nice. Mm-hmm. You need that bit of rockiness. To it. What do you?
And sorry, not only this, but the biggest enemy of a farmer, of a vintner, is humidity, because humidity is the focus for all the is the food for all the fungi that attack the leaves and that attack the grapes. And I don't want to get too technical to this, but if you are in dry weathers, is where you naturally can make the less intervention grapes, the less intervention wines, organic, biodynamic, natural, call it as however you want to call it. But the whole philosophy is to go like really, really naked, put the nature as the protagonist, and kind of like keep the ego of the winemaker in the pocket. You know?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I think the first message here is encourage everybody that travels to the beautiful city of Barcelona to travel 35 minutes west and enjoy the beauty of this Northern Penedès, the Montserrat mountain range, the valleys, and walk the potential of Conca. That's the way of understanding the wine regions, no? Away from architecture, which I love, but this is not about architecture building, it's about winemaking. So away from design, away from like big tours, like really going authentic, walk the little dirt roads that connect the villages in Penedès, cross the river, and really feel the potential of the area.
Without like a Frank Gehry hotel, right, plopped in the middle of it.
Exactly. and nothing against this, but we have made all the mistakes, Nathan. So, you know, we were bankrupt in the mid-90s because we did too much effort in architecture, and then we thought that wine was about packaging and labels, and we won all the design awards in prestigious 1990s Barcelona. Like, we've done all the mistakes, you know, and we will continue to do many. But really, wine is not about this. It's really about feeling the place, and you start by feeling it by walking it and understanding. Since I am living in the middle of the farm last 5 years, I spend every day like learning something different. No, from flavor profile, let me just say one quick thing.
Yeah,
we are in an oceanic valley. This is geology. Huh? This is geography history. So in the mid-Miocene, we were covered by the ocean for 3 million years. That's 18 million years ago until 15 million years ago. When the ocean went back to the shore, all that richness, all that life is carbonatized in the soil. So the mother rock that defines the valley where we're in the landscape that we're seeing today is a mother rock with origin in between 18 and 15 million years ago. Is all limestone with fossils.
With fossils.
And this... But diatomeas, but like incredible amount of diatomeas.
Really?
This is what I like people to think about Conca. So if you like fruity, drink champagne. But if you like mineral, give Conca an opportunity. Because it's said that we are working with nature, low yields, etc., able to show the most mineral sparkling wines that have been made. And this is not something of the last 5 years, it's last 150 years.
And I mean, is it just a coincidence we have a large American audience? But that's kind of an American palate thing too, right? That's something that they like out of their wines more than the kind of fruity or sweeter things, or is it?
Well, we have, let's not forget that America is the paradise for Pinot Grigio, eh? So success, but I agree.
Let's not forgive too quickly.
But I agree that the more the palate matures, the more we enjoy minerality, the more we enjoy tension, the more we enjoy austerity. When we are not expert with wine, although I don't like the word because nobody's expert in wine and you can do a blind tasting, but we search more for impact, no? And especially when we're paying our dollars, we want impact back, no? And I think the more wine you drink, the more you appreciate the balance, the harmony, the austerity, and more than anything, that when you're sipping that liquid, your mind and your spirit is traveling to that place of origin.
So you should be able to uncork this bottle in New York, wherever on earth you are, and then somehow be looking over the Montserrat Mountains and just kind of feel.
This is exactly the idea, and this is what I think the most successful wine regions in the world have been able to do, is create this essence, interpret this authenticity, that then when you're drinking that beautiful Nebbiolo, you go to the slopes of Serra Lunga d'Alba or La Morra, and even you can see, this landscape, these chestnuts and the cold and the truffles and the food there and everything.
That is true. And an amazing hiking, the kind of walking from the hilltop fortress to hilltop fortress. When you talk about trying to tease people out of Barcelona, like you said, 30 minutes out, I'm not even sure that I would have put on the top 10 things that I know about Barcelona, a town I know pretty well, that there's a wine region right here. I would have thought, well, maybe, Priorat or, places that are a bit further out. How do you do that? You just get people to, you just start making good shit and they'll come.
Yeah. Let me answer that question in another direction. Between 1 hour and 2 hours from Barcelona, there is an undiscovered treasure that I really want to use this podcast to help people discover this. Empordà, for example, north of Barcelona, with so-called Spanish Tuscany, is like this pool of medieval villages, which is incredible in the Girona province. It's super special. When you move a little bit further to the west, there is all the Plana de Vic with this incredible gastronomy. You hit the Montserrat mountain range. Of course, you can drive a little bit further north to the Pyrenees, where there's like this amazing gastronomy, little villages, etc. Go south, Penedès. Cross Penedès and get to the Sister Sense area of Santes Creus, Montblanc villages with these old monasteries and everything around them, no? All the vegetables, the landscape, it's spectacular. And today we were talking at lunchtime about Priorat, which is something that you cannot miss because it's the most beautiful wine region in the planet.
Those are big words right there. Most beautiful wine region in the planet.
Yeah, to me, the authenticity that Priorat offers is what makes it like really, really spectacular.
one of the things that people, I think, don't know about Catalonia in particular, from a great distance, is the fact that it is kind of at least eight landscapes, or, you know, in one. I mean, it's a very small chunk of the earth, but it is, this is what we were talking about. I mean, it's a blue sky day out there, and, you know, we're close to the Mediterranean. You're packing everybody up to go skiing a short drive away for the weekend. And, you know, this is kind of what Catalonia can do for you. So for you, wine comes into it because you have these very specific valleys next to specific rivers who are going to have a specific taste. Mm-hmm. And cava is just, it feels too flimsy of a description of something like that. Tell me again what the wine, particularly the sparkling wine that you served at lunch was. This is this sort of orangish, really beautiful, just very fine sparkling wine. Is this a special reserve? Is it?
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Nathan. This is a very limited production that La Viña Més Alta gives us. La Viña Més Alta in Catalan is the highest vineyard, and it's a very small plot on top of the property where we have the poorest soils of all, where the vines auto-regulate their yields. And I actually planted Pinot Noir in that plot in my young years, and a big mistake.
You fool.
I wanted to make like the most elegant possible rosé, and you know, in my family, rosé is like, oh, baby, this is no real stuff. No, very classic, very elegant. Believe me, I tasted such elegant rosés that there's a potential here. So anyhow, I planted Pinot Noir, too much color, low acidity, total mess. So 4 years later, I regrafted those plants with indigenous Catalan red sumoll, Charelo Vermell and Bastard Negra, and this is what Texturas da Pedra comes up with.
Okay. These are, and this is the hill just behind your head here,
mm-hmm.
where it grows. I mean, it's kind of an incredible, and I do, with much apologies to listeners, you cannot get this. It's limited, sorry. But what can they get? What are they most likely to run into from you guys in the States, say?
So from that mistake in La Viña Més Alta, I bumped into Antoine Villecar, who is now making the wines Villecar Salmon that you may be familiar with. And I say, Antoine, you know, you make this most beautiful rosé in Champagne. And I'm trying to make this. He said, Pepe, everybody in Champagne talks about Seigne, but really the secret is to do it by blending, you know. And this is what my great-grandfather did, and he was the first one to blend Coteau Champenois with whites, and that's how Villecar Salmon Rosé icon was originated in sometime mid 1800s, something like this. So we started this. We understood that to make this blend, we needed to find an indigenous grape that ripened at the same pH, that means at the same parameters than the whites. And we came up with a wine called Denit.
Denit. What is this?
This is our sparkling rosé, which is has become the signature of the rosé sparklings in our country.
How do you spell it?
D-E-N-I-T.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Somebody in America told me you shouldn't call this because it relates to some kind of bugs or something, but...
like a knit. Yeah. I don't know. It sounds like you are not really open for lots of feedback from the marketing crowd. You seem like you have your own very specific ideas. You're going to do it. So to hell with that.
Seriously, this rosé is something that people may know. They need from Raventos or Raventos Rosé sparkling wine. You can find pretty open in
all right. Well, that's going to have to do, people. You won't have that epiphany, that gorgeous moment that I had at the table just down there when we opened the reserve, the very limited edition.
In white, we work with Charello, which is the king, meaning that its flavor profile, balance profile, agriculturally is the best grape to work with, and it has survived generations because of its quality. Then we have Macabeu and Parellada, who are also very interesting, not so qualitative, but it's this is like an agricultural diversification insurance risk. No? So basically what happens is when you work with different grapes, you have different moments of flowering, different moments of harvesting, so you are less exposed to the weather.
If something terrible happens to one grape,
have the other, so you can survive. This is why in Champagne there's Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier. This is why in Bordeaux there is Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc. This is why in Burgundy there is Chardonnay, Pinot Noir. This is why in La Rioja there's Tempranillo, Graciano, y Mazuelo. And then in reds we have Sumoll, Garnacha, Samson, mainly. Charello Barmei, we're also recuperating, and now we're really working to find more grapes that have been kind of abandoned because of the invasion of the French grapes. Mainly, we're such a young country, Nathan, that after the dictatorship, you know, like anything that would come from France would be better. So we took away most of our beautiful indigenous grapes and planted Cabernet and Merlot all over the place. So now we're trying to get back.
Trying to rip them out in the Pinot Noirs, the exactly. mistakes of the past.
Exactly.
And there's also, what is this, the Bastard Negre?
Yeah, Bastard Negre is a beautiful red grape that also has been planted in Sardinia, called Bastardo Nero there, southern in Catalan, and in Valencia shores called Moristel, inland Rioja, Graciano. It's rustic, beautiful, high acid, intense fruits, really, really well adapted to our shores.
And what are you doing with that? You have some single grape wines that you're making with that, right?
I am making a very, very small natural Bastard Negre here in query style in the garage. And then
in these giant clay amphora, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah, in your kind of magic workshop. Mm-hmm. Why, I had asked you this when I was down there, but why does a man who, you know, sort of commands this impressive machinery for putting out tons and tons of wine, then go into his own garage and just tinker and, you know, in a place where you could be parking cars, say?
First of all, we don't have an immense facility, but yeah, true, in sparkling wine, the machinery is quite extensive, and then it seems that sometimes this is bigger than what it is. No, but
how many bottles are you doing?
We make 400,000 bottles every year, depending on the weather characteristics. No,
and where does that put you in terms of producers in the region?
So Moët & Chandon makes 30 million bottles, and I don't know, and maybe. Smaller. This is like the big grower champagne kind of volume. Freixenet makes 130 million bottles, for example. Codorniu makes 40 million bottles. This is why Cava has such an inertia of cheap. No.
Got it. So with your moderately sized output, you're still trying things on in the garage.
The garage is like why cars? No, I mean we put the cars outside and it's a perfect small place, clean and cold, and it's sterile. No, meaning that the yeasts that are living in the skin of the grapes, when we bring them in, are going to be the protagonists of the fermentation. And that was something that really interested me, is that when you make spontaneous fermentation, there is no contamination of other yeast that have been in the cellar for previous vintages.
Got it. Well, in a place where you are 21 generations into making wine, I'm sure there's just a lot of old wines floating around in the
air.
There's
a lot of old yeast ready to contaminate anything.
You had mentioned the economic crisis of the 90s. You had to basically go into exile then, right? You didn't live here.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of moved around different cities. Is that right? It wasn't sustainable.
Yeah, my father had to sell the family house and then move to Barcelona, where I grew up, and then had to sell some vineyards and everything to go back on track. No. We had difficult times, made a lot of mistakes, and But then basically, kind of like my life has been a tension towards the dream of recuperating such a beautiful tradition of so many, many years, no more than 500 years cultivating this farm. So, again, no, when things started to be better, I said to my father, before the kids are too old, let's go to America and try to create distribution there. That's what was the why of us spending these first years, and it's been a fantastic experience. And then with the first benefits that we started to build, we refurbished this house, we refurbished the old guest house, and we kind of like brought the life back to the farm. Now we live together with two draft horses, and we have a herd of sheep and goat that are grazing now here freely in the semi-freely, because if not, they would go to the Pyrenees, but in the farm until bud break, when they are going to be living in the forest. No, I have this great American farmer called Joel Saladin, who I quote him when I love this quote. He says, you know, people think farming is about this. Farming is all about fencing, you know? So
you've been building fences here. Building
fences for the sheep, and then we're trying to bring back all the breeds of different animals that belong to the Mediterranean farm. For example, the pigs also, a local breed called Porc Ral d'Avinyó from northern Catalunya. We have the chickens, el gall del Penedès i gallines del Penedès, who lay beautiful eggs. And we work with these people from La Seu d'Urgell, who are experts in ornithology. We designed these nests for all the birds that used to live here before the era of confusion, and then with the pesticides and all the chemistry in the farm, they left. And now we build, design these nests, and we install these nests, and they are all coming back into different parts of the farm. We underground 4 kilometers. Almost 3 miles of electric lines, all to protect from birds, to eliminate.
You buried all your lines.
Yes, yes.
So what does this have to do with making wine?
Well, I'm a believer that to express origin, you really need to bring a lot of life into your farm, and the principle is very simple. The more diversity there is in your farm, the more richness there is in your farm, and the more resistant and strong your vines will be, the least treatments they will need, and the more authentic wine you can make. I really left the idea of perfect wine a long time ago, and I think my duty is to help make the most authentic possible wine. Mm. And what is more authentic than this wine that comes from these grapes that grow in a farm where animal, man, and plant live closing the circles, small trophic chains, no, like creating their own compost with the animals that are grazing in this farm, and so forth.
So it has to be some sort of, what were you saying before about closing the circuit, like mm-hmm. just having this farm that has kind of all the components together. I mean, I guess it kind of reminds me of that Three Sisters concept, where you always grow things together. But for you, it can be viniculture and pigs and goats.
Yeah, and the idea is that every system generates its own flora, fauna, and microbiotics, no? So the more different systems you have, it's like a patchwork of systems within the farm, the more diverse that your farm will be. So for example, it's as important as making the grapes, is also when we have our fields that are resting, where to regenerate the soil, we are planting wheat, and with this we create food for the animals, but also we are helping another system to exist, which will generate its own flora, our own fauna, our microbiotics. Makes sense?
Yeah.
The same with the olive groves, the same with the almond groves, the same with the sheep, all the different protagonists of the farm.
Right across the street, that was part of the old lands that had been sold off and is now disconnected from your family and was sort of bought by American
hedge fund.
A hedge fund. I mean, it's I was kind of thinking about that. It's an insane juxtaposition where here you are with your family and your dogs and your name and your heritage and, you know, kind of really trying to live on these slopes in this particular way. And then right across the street, you've got, you know, the Wolves of Wall Street. I don't know who they are. Maybe they're amazing people, but that's what's happening to a lot of the wine world, as well as a lot of agricultural in general. It's just becoming more commodified. Do you feel the satisfaction of being a counterweight against our times? Do you, or is it just trying to keep your head down?
I think there's room for everybody, and for me, I am not an example at all, no. And I think the question in nowadays, no, with this change of value, is more of, do I live simply enough? No? And when you ask yourself this question, in my case, I realize that not at all. but I think, being that said about that there's room for everybody, I think we're living in a very interesting moment, Nathan. I see that with the young generations, they question a lot the success rules that have driven our generation and our parents' generation, no? And questioning that this idea of success. And we see this with all people like really caring for environment and for nature and from maintaining a better planet, no, and well, trying to not only maintain but recuperate what we lost, no. True be said, also there's always been a big trend of people like in care for the needed, and I think this is also something that maybe needs to regain more power, and not only the care for the landscape, which is something sometimes a little bit more marketing-ish. No, I am very, very responsible because I take care of the landscape. Me as a farmer, for me, is critical, but I question myself, do we care for the people that are in need? No.
Yeah. Well, but and wine's funny because there is a lot of bullshit in wine. You know, it seems to be, and everybody, you know, can pick your different bullshit. But
that's a quote I use a lot, but I didn't know you were allowed to put it in your podcast.
we are definitely allowed to put it in the podcast. What is the bullshit in wine? When you say that, what is it referring to?
The bullshit in wine is that because it's so impossible to objectivize taste, to be objective when you're tasting wine. It's so impossible to say this and this costs this to make, or this, like, there's so much room for marketing that then this is what becomes the bullshit.
The people who are yapping at you about Cava or Denit or...
Yeah, or, you know, this wine is great because it's made like this and that, and there is very little, first of all, too often what is said is not what's really made, and this is very, very difficult to track.
In terms of what they're saying, like, this is organic or this is
organic heritage. Organic, thanks, thankfully now it's certified, so okay. So it has to be certified now. But for example, in my dear region, so much wine that has the name of my region comes from other regions because the big players can buy it cheaper. Uh-huh. And this is the biggest drama that we have, for example, in Cava, that there is no control of where the wines are coming from. No? So from something as big as this, putting Penedès and bringing the wine from La Mancha, which is the cheapest region in Spain, and people saying Bordeaux when the wine is coming from Chile.
Right, and they're just bottling it here.
Yeah, because Bordeaux sells more than Chile. No?
Yeah.
Like this would be a big bullshit, but also at a smaller level, you know, like super prestigious wines, you know, that they say that cost $200 because I use, a type of recipe with this wood or whatever, and then that it's impossible to track. No? So, yeah, there's a lot of bullshit. Another bullshit would be the architecture bullshit, no? Like to build these big, beautiful architects wineries where we're not selling architecture, which I always say I would like to be an architect if I don't make wine. But
you've seen the checks that go out to those guys.
But no, not for that. I have sensibility for architecture. I think it's a very important métier and with a very important responsibility. I am a fan of Mies van der Rohe. Well, I'm crazy about it. But now we're talking about wine, not about architecture.
Yeah.
The same with the names and the packaging. Haven't you seen these ridiculous labels? Now it's all about, you know, like the yellowtail effect, for example, no? So really we need to I think, step back and look at nature, origin, farming, and decomplicate the thing.
So that's the front facing, the commercial facing, but then you also have on the winemaking side, you have, you know, kind of fevers that grip winemakers. We were talking about Demeter, which is, I don't quite understand it, but I think it's something about the cycles of the moon and the lunar phases, and it's an adding like some sort of shamanistic qualities to the process of winemaking.
Yeah, this also helps to complicate the whole thing, no? Like, yeah, when it's time to use more wood or less wood or so on, no? It's of course, there have to be trends, but they kind of complicate the expression of sight and the work and the connection with earth, which at the end of the day is what is more beautiful about wine. No? Talking about Demeter, claro, Demeter brings fantastic things like a connection with the farm, the compost, the recuperating the farm organism, and then also it brings more esoteric aspects to the table, which kind of, in my opinion, make people more confused. No, demonstrable that demonstrable. Does this make any
sense?
Yeah,
demonstrable or like, demonstrable. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. But here in the village, when the moon is descendant, you know, you go to the hairdresser and there's big line because everybody knows that the hair grows slower. So by the cut, you know, you have a longer.
This is an actual thing that happens?
This is another thing that happens in all the villages in Europe, not only in San Saturnino de Noia. Because as you know, when the moon is descendant, makes descendant pressures that, for example, create the tides.
Yes, the tides. Okay. The tides I can believe in. I see
it. Okay. Then the tides that you can believe in, see, you can also, you can do your thing with your beautiful hair that we still have.
Yes.
But also, for example, it's the same with the plants. So when the moon is ascendant, it creates pressure that the saba circulates more towards the roots. And then it's the moment where you want to do the pruning so you don't cut, you don't damage the plant with your cuts. So this is something that, while it seems to you esoteric, for me, it has a lot of common sense.
That's actually true.
What is more esoteric is, for example, when we go into the preparations where we have to mix cow manure that we have been buried into cow inside cow horns into our soils during all the winter season, and then we underground them in the spring, and then we do the dynamization. We mix it with water, and we dynamize this water, creating circulation in two different directions, creating what's called a vortex. And then with this water, with the cow manure dynamized, we spray it in the soil, enhancing the connection of the roots with the minerals. No? There I can understand we're starting to confuse a lot of people.
I mean, that's like real Eye of Newt, bubbling cauldron, witch's coven stuff. Mm-hmm. You're putting cow manure into a cow horn, burying it underground at a certain time, bringing it back up. And wow. Yeah. Okay. You don't need to do that to make great wine.
I think you don't need to do that to make great wine. I think biodynamics can be criticized by being too esoteric, while there is a very important centerpiece, in my opinion, that biodynamics bring is that to even control further the application of copper and sulfur and chemistries following the organic movement and taking it to the next level. And also the recuperation of the farm ecosystem, creating your own compost, making your compost a centerpiece or an important piece of all your winemaking or viticulture philosophy. But there are other parts of the Demeter certification which are hard to believe, that kind of, not to say, don't make much sense, inspired by this Rudolf Steiner philosophy.
Yes.
Who is a man that at that time he was not much knowledgeable about wine, not only that he didn't like to drink wine, but he didn't cultivate a grape in his life. So again, bullshit can come to all the parts of the winemaking cycle.
Right, so you have Steiner, a guy who did not like wine, but was throwing down, you know, laws that caused people to go out, you know, by the light of a full moon and collect esoteric ingredients for...
It wasn't his fault. It was somebody later that said, this is going to be interesting, that's going to help me sell my wine, and then brought this into the puzzle.
So it all comes back to marketing at the end.
I would like to say that best marketing is no marketing. This is a quote of my friend Andy Page from Chicago, again. And I think that in wine, the future is the past.
The future is the past. I mean, strip all that other bullshit away and get back to what you
had
been
doing. Don't spend money in technology. Don't spend money in pharmaceuticals for your grapes, pharmaceuticals for your musts or your wines. Just try to understand your place and, if possible, talk to the old people that are working in the vineyards next door. Work together, learn from them, and just, you know, read a little bit of history of the place that I'm sure there is. And that's the future of wine. That's what's going to be of interest. Something real, something authentic, something naked, and made with care and passion. And the more detail that you can apply to it, the better the wine will be. And the less detail, maybe some vintages will be fantastic, and some of them you're going to make a little mess, but it's also okay.
You have records that go back to 1400 something.
Yeah. Late 1400, yes.
Late
1497.
1497 of people in your family line making wine on this property. How is... I mean, we always think of, like, history is just starting to accelerate and accelerate. Do you feel the pressure of, like, how, you know, how can you avoid being one of the last generations to do this? I mean, having four kids helps. You've got lots of options to choose from in the next vintner class.
Yeah, hopefully one of the next to continue. But really, not at all, because there is too much wine in the world, you know, like it's only wine. So it's okay. For now, maybe one day I will grow a little bit of concern, but it's about doing it right and having fun and living the moment and living the present. Yes, though, accepting that maintaining this tradition is something very beautiful.
Yeah. What happens in your family if somebody just has a poor palate? You know, like, you know, a great-grandfather who, or great-great, or, you know... If you have this many generations, how is it possible that they're all able to make wine and taste it?
Palate, like everything, is something that you can educate.
So it's not possible that just one generation is kind of fallow. And
this is a little bit also for the movie theater, you know. the palate is something that you educate with everything. And this, you know, this thing of the generations, let's admit, this also has a marketing side to it, because, to be honest with you, I think every generation has to start from scratch. I didn't know how to make wine when I was a kid, and I had to learn everything. So
there's not a secret ledger that's sort of passed from...
Not at all. The only thing is that maybe you have the feeling, you know, when you're here, that, I don't know, there's an energy that you have, this sense of belonging that makes you, you know, want to spend more time in, I don't know, out here and you know, walk out the door and feel, you know, breathe the spirit, breathe the temperatures, breathe the air, breathe what's happening. You know, that try to make the wine more by feeling and less by recipe.
I'm like fourth generation down in Key West, and for me that, like, inspires, like, very deep emotional resonance when I go down there. I'm sure the math doesn't work this way, but I'm just trying to imagine that feeling multiplied by, you know, a little over five. Mm-hmm. And you must just be, like, surging with land power, you know, just that vibe of, like, spiritual past and heritage. Although that would be pretty obnoxious for you at the end of the day. Cause,
you know, so I like what you said about Key West. There's something about where we come from. There is something about it also. We cannot banalize it.
I'll follow up that question, though, specifically with your kids. If all four of them are like, hey, I'm moving on, What do you feel about that? If they're going to leave the wine trade altogether?
Maybe it's true that this saddens me more than I thought. But to be honest with you, I don't think about it much.
Well, you have time. You're in the prime of your wine making, Kvevri hoarding, garage tinkering self. Well, the wines you make are outstanding, and I got to sample the ones that people at home can't even try, which I feel incredibly lucky for. So thank you, Pepe.
Thank you, Nathan, for traveling the world, trying to share in your podcast stories of smart people and some of not so smart people like me. And it's a pleasure to have you here in Conca del Riuanoia and anytime. I hope. We still have a gastronomic celebration pending.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Trip from Roads and Kingdoms is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Alexa Van Sickle is our producer. Theme music by Dan the Automator. Episode illustration by Daisy D. Sound mastering and composing by Ricardo Gutierrez. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Next week, the second of our three episodes in Barcelona, it's a new one for us, the Mexico-born chief rabbi of Barcelona, Daniel Askenazi, who happens to be a huge craft beer fan. Over a few of those beers, we talked about spirituality, how to handle racists, and why Moroccan Jews just sing more than the rest of us. We will meet you there.